presentation by the minister on the medium-term budget policy statement. So we have invited stakeholders who want to comment on the medium-term budget policy statement. Also, others have responded to the advertisements that were there in the press, and we are grateful for that. Sure. According to our... My name is Mshiyeni Sokoni. I'm with co-chairperson Honorable Tebogo Tshane. Chairperson, good morning. The chairperson is very fresh this morning, just flown from Durban. This morning is here already. Yes. According to the program, we will start with a presentation by Ms. Laura Polkart of Sisfire. We are 10 minutes behind time, but I'm sure we will try to make up for that time. She is on my left. You're welcome, madam. You can address us.
Thank you. Firstly, I want to say thank you for giving me this time, or giving us this time. I'm very pleased to be here and very grateful to be able to comment on financial matters. It wasn't always the case that we could, and so we're very grateful to be able to do so. Firstly, even though my name is Laura Pollock and I'm not Rob Thompson, as you can see, Rob Thompson actually compiled this presentation, but he did also share it with members of the ceasefire campaign. So, in fact, I speak for the organization. Rob Thompson himself is a professor of actuarial science, and so I'm sorry he's not here to answer questions instead of me, but I will do my best. Just to give you a little background and history of the ceasefire campaign, those of us who were around during the anti-apartheid struggle will remember the End Conscription campaign, which, as you know, was a movement of white conscripts who were not prepared to fight against their black compatriots. And they formed an organization that was anti-conscription. They weren't necessarily conscientious objectors or peace activists. They were very much anti-apartheid activists. In 1993, the End Conscription campaign decided to close the organization, although people might have noticed about 2 years ago they had a commemoration of its existence and its beginning in 1983. But they closed it, and at the end of the conference, which was closed by Nelson, which was addressed by Nelson Mandela, there was a feeling that generally South Africa was still very militarized, having had militarization both from our liberators and from internal apartheid forces. So some of the people who were at that conference decided to establish a demilitarist organization, which is also committed to peace and nonviolence, and I'll give you a bit more about that. The actual name of the campaign was taken from Oliver Tambo, at Chris Hani's funeral, when Tokyo Sekwali indicated to the MK people to cease fire, and we took the name from there. It was a nice beginning. So our mission is to promote a vision of human security that maximizes human potential by conscientizing society to the possibility of a world without wars and armaments, so that the resources currently expended on militarization can be utilized for social development. We are very much concerned, obviously, with human security, and the purpose of our submission is to motivate and submit ceasefire proposal. As you can see, we're concerned with human versus military security, military spending in South Africa, arguments against military spending, and ceasefire proposals. That's what constitutes our submission. Human versus military security, which is a very modern concept to many people, although it really has been around for quite some time. But as you can see, these are the things that really we feel constitute human security. And they are the very things that we felt right at the beginning of our democracy, more money should be spent on than arms. And they are, of course, housing, food security, adequate policing, education, health, power, water supplies, power, energy, may be better understood. Human security, this kind of picture does not for us contribute to human security. Of course, we understand there are budgetary constraints. There's always the guns versus butter arguments. But a lot of economists measure military expenditure as a service, and that means apart from the secondary effects, MILEX, as the militarists like to call it, has a neutral effect on the economy. But as we try and explain, if you're saying, well, you know, it's just part of the mix, well, why don't you just dig holes and fill them, because you'll be creating work and jobs and things and contributing to GDP, because it's the same kind of things. So it's kind of like a stalemate to say, you know, it's the guns versus butter debate, because every rand spent on military security is a rand that could be better spent on human security. People's experience of insecurity arises from lack of basic services, not from military threats. This obviously is an idealistic position that modern warfare is an evil. And currently, where there's a very considerable feeling that modern warfare does not constitute what some theorists would call a just war, in terms of that developed by Cicero, St. Augustine, and numerous subsequent authors. Even a just war today is an evil. Modern warfare is a totally unacceptable way of resolving conflict. During the past century, civilian casualties frequently exceeded combatant casualties, and certainly there are lots of examples of that. In Africa, the displacement of people by war and the disruption of their lives and economic activities is particularly tragic. The military euphemism, collateral damage, it's such a clinical term, but it just means numbers of bodies. Like many other military euphemisms, is designed to relativize the evils of modern war. Modern war is unnecessary. We all believe that it's undesirable, but most people will add the rider that it may be a necessary evil. To the purist, no evil is necessary, but even to the strategist, quickness of the militarist to defend war is unjustifiable. When people ask, what about Hitler? And this is Rob saying, I asked, do you really think Hitler could have ruled Britain? He couldn't even rule the Norwegian teachers. Well, these are some of the examples from the Second World War that he's referring to, where non-violent resistance counteracted invasion and being run over by the Nazis. Yeah, I'm going too slow.
Can I disrupt you?
Yeah.
I don't know if you're presenting from the same paper that we were having, or are you still giving a background?
We're getting there.
Oh, okay.
Okay. All right. Okay. So now we're going to, I'm just going to, you have that paper, but that's the submission. So we did a presentation. Okay. All right. I think you want me to go quicker. That's what it is. Okay. There's predominance of men here, I think. So what we're looking at here is the fact that we argue we have no enemies anywhere. We have military supremacy over our neighbors, and logistic difficulties that face any other country in conducting conditional war at the southern tip of Africa. The only power that could invade South Africa is the United States, and they wouldn't use conventional weapons. Okay, I'm getting the feeling that you don't really want to let me talk too much about the mythology of war, but there it is. It's an outmoded mythology that rests on the undemocratic, hierarchical, and gendered view of the world. Christianity has been guilty of spreading this worldview, though the other monotheistic faith must take their share of the blame for this too. But once again, it is a dated view. And we always get the militarizing of non-military services. So in order to make use of what we call idle soldiers, in peace times, they are used for non-military purposes. So we have soldiers building bridges in the Eastern Cape, soldiers involved in search and rescue, soldiers involved in peacemaking, in police support, in hydrography, etc. And we feel that the SANDF uses that to win hearts and minds, which was not unlike the old SADF. Because of the arms embargo against South Africa, the past 8 years we developed a substantial military industry. Apart from selling unwanted weapons, systems like the Roy Falk to the SANDF, and Denel is now attempting unsuccessfully to engage in international war profiteering. Because of the unquestioned place of the military in South Africa, Denel is treated as a national asset. I'm not so sure that's particularly relevant here, so we'll move on. We also make mention of South Africa's weapons purchase program. It was followed by the purchase of fighter planes by Botswana. In other words, military defense promotes local arms races. So if one particular country in a region starts buying arms, then the others feel they have to buy arms as well. So we're going to look at human versus military security and military spending in South Africa. I think now we're getting down to what the paper is about, the submission. The military industrial complex likes to use a percentage of GDP as an indicator of how much should be spent on defense. And there's always a feeling that they're trying to increase the percentage of GDP, and generally people talk about a 2% as a benchmark, a recommended standard. But note how real spending in constant dollar terms has increased. This is our spending here up on the wall, and you will see that in terms of our GDP, we're spending 1.3% on it, and yet in real terms we're spending quite a bit more. The next slide shows us, shows current and projected military spending. Note the small effect of the end of spending on the arms deal, which you can have a look at, and if you look at your presentation, there's a bigger elaboration on that. If we are to ever get to the end of paying for the arms, then there still seems to be some need to increase this defense budget, which military spending, so we have to consider that. If this is how it's projected. We're trying to talk about other military spending. There's a lot of other military spending that perhaps we are unaware of, so we've got a much bigger outlay on military spending than it appears. And, propping up the null is one of them. We're moving on. I'm sorry, I know you were in a hurry. Now we're looking at further. Who said 2% anyway? It's always talked about that it's 2% as GDP as a World Bank recommendation or benchmark or standard, but even the World Bank capitalist capitalist as it is, did not recommend 2% of GDP. That was NATO, which is militarist, threats due to aggressive posture. It has to it has to engage with that. It's industrialized countries, and it's not relevant to South Africa. And this is particularly for me an interesting perspective on it. There's always this argument that if you know you need to spend now to ensure that you are prepared for war. But in fact, when the insured has been paying premiums, if you talk about it in that way, and an insured event happens, the policy pays out. But with military spending, when the taxpayer has been paying for military spending in peacetime and war breaks out, then military spending increases. People are killed. Extensive damage is done to property. Military spending, the alternatives, the Costa Rica option, disband the army, the halfway option, mothball the army, three, the military option. So we're moving on now to arguments against. We've done our arguments. We're going to talk about ceasefire proposals, which is to demilitarize the non-military functions of the SANDF. This can be a lot clearer. We can talk about it a little bit more. We probably need to establish special agencies as required, a Coast Guard, strengthen border policing. I heard on the radio this morning that the SANDF is asking for enormous amounts of money because they can't protect our borders, so to speak. And I think that's something that one should perhaps apply a lateral thinking to, and how do we deal with that problem? And then there's other recommendations: establish national search and rescue and emergencies organization, and transfer hydrography to the Surveyor General. So that's the way we would think of demilitarizing the non-military functions of the SANDF. And then it may be idealistic to suggest that develop civil society's capacity for defensive resistance and peacekeeping intervention. Well, I think any of us who were in the struggle against apartheid will remember that a lot of it was exactly that. It's not to take away from the role of the liberation armies, but at the same time, there was a considerable amount of resistance that was not militarist. So we're suggesting you can mothball the SANDF, reduce the defense vote to 0.5% of GDP, increase the number of government jobs in human security, and I think that that's probably the most sensible thing that you can think of. So civil society and political leaders should not get ready for the Costa Rica option. It would be lovely to think that we could consider that, but we are very doubtful that civil society and political leadership would ever contemplate that. And we certainly do not want to be perceived as being a pie-in-the-sky organization. But we can train civil society for defensive resistance and peacekeeping intervention. South Africa has a very good peace missions paper policy, but constantly argued that it should be more civilian-oriented, it involve more civilian institutions, etc. Can convert military land to peaceful use, constant ongoing arguments around land, and again reduce spending to 5.5% of GDP. So our proposals are interim measures. The scope of this committee is inadequate to deal with radical proposals such as those proposed. It is therefore proposed that an inclusive civil society-based process be initiated to reconsider South Africa's defence. In the meantime, it is proposed that no further steps be taken that will compromise that process. I'm just looking here from, this is what we, if you look at this new table, what we've got is, if you look at the blue, that's the actual budget MTEF. and then there's ceasefire proposals. So what we're suggesting is that consideration be given to reducing that, bringing it down. So we're going into 2002, it's on a par with what is being proposed, but as you go on, you reduce that budget more and more, and you have then free up money for more critical needs. Okay, I think that that's the end of the presentation.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Portcat. Can I invite comments? Honorable Mashiko, Honorable Depierre, Honorable Mashile, Honorable Ramatagana, Honorable Dr. Rabi, and Honorable Swart. Comment, Mashiko?
Thank you, Chairperson. I've been following the presentation and the fact that the presenter spoke about human security. And on page 2, he actually elaborated on what human security is, first chapter. And we realized that those are actually the government priorities, which are actually being catered for in the budget and even in the adjustment program. And what, as a result, what I don't understand is this shifting to all those priorities that are at the heart of the nation and are really definitely being catered for. Maybe some, I don't understand the rationale behind the shifting. And especially that the Department of Defense has a mandate, which I think when the budget was done, looked at, and the portfolio committee engaged in the review program, looked at the mandate, and which contributed to whatever the policy statement of this MTBPS. And the fact that the presenter also mentioned that there's a review committee to which they'll be presenting, which has a very good step that will start the process of whatever she has come to present to us, and we should properly look at all her suggestions and the fact that the need for the budget for defense is not there. And as a country, I think that the country is looking at all these other aspects and looking at how do we divide this big slice. We don't just start by dividing it by moving functions to the functions that are already inexistent. But the presentation is acceptable. But maybe as she elaborates on what other members are going to ask, or in her response, I'll put into context what her suggestions and this big reduction they anticipate and propose refer to, because we are all concerned about human security. That's why it is the government priority. But her further explanation maybe will enlighten me more. Thank you, Chairperson.
Well, thank you very much, Honorable Mashiko, for the comment. Honorable Debia.
Chairperson, we live in a real world, and it's a reality that there's organizations in this country that want to destabilize this country. That's not a secret. So every country needs a defense force in some other way. It would assist us if the presenter of this organization could have given us, and there was a slide, but I missed it. It was too quick. the recommendations. You were the Minister of Finance. What would you have told the country on the 21st of October with the challenges we face, referring to what you just presented to this committee?
Honorable Mashida.
Thanks, Chairperson. While we really thank Ceasefire for having made time to come and participate in the public hearing and share with us some of the historical activities that have led to there being a chair, I tend to have a picture that Ceasefire is simplifying difficult things, and although is that one understand the reasoning and the thinking, as Honorable De Beer has indicated, that we are in the real world. We have fought for freedom, and part of the freedom that we have fought for was to be part of the global world, because we have been isolated as South Africa, living in small little island. Now we are part of the global world. Now, all the countries that we have as of today, in terms of military capabilities, are they on the rise or are they scaling down? Because we are part of this global world. Are these countries on the rise in terms of military capability, or are they on the down slide? In other words, scaling down military capabilities. Chair, we have had explanations and reasons for the Protection of Information Bill, which is still coming to be finalized in Parliament. And some of the things that informs that specific bill is that we are vulnerable every day as a country, as members or citizens of this country, from real threat of outside or hot heads in the world. I would like to hear an explanation from Ceasefire based on the statement that says we don't have enemies or real enemies or whatever it has been structured that sentence, in the light of what happened in Libya. What has happened in Libya? Should that situation arise, should South Africa raise hands and celebrate? What informs the position of Ceasefire? Is this a research project to demilitarize or do away with the military, reduce the spending to 0.5? Is there anywhere else where there is this kind of information that informs the position of Ceasefire? And the 0.5% you are recommending on your last bar chart, it looks like it is leveling at 20 billion. Is that the 0.5, or the 0.5 is indicative only? And then if it is indicative, what informs the 20 billion where it looks like you are leveling off on your bar chart as you move to the outer years of 2016-2017. Thanks, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Chairperson Mashile. Honorable Ramatlakane.
Thank you, Chairperson. And let's appreciate the presenter on the suggestions that has been presented. But, Chair, I know some of the questions have been posed already, but I'm just wondering whether the presentation itself appreciate the policy perspective of the country first, because if he doesn't understand that, and this is a total sum of narratives that seeks to change the policy directive of the country, then it is insufficient. In my humble submission, it is insufficient for us to actually cease with it, because there must be informing perspective and policy that arrived at what you then either fund your policy. Here I'm not getting it. So if I start with where I want to end, I start with the disagreement with the 0.5% of the GDP as an investment to the defense of a country. So I start with the difficulty in agreeing that because I don't know what informs such a perspective. So we're a bit poorer. In my view, I'm poorer without understanding what informs this perspective. We know that, and I haven't read in a document what is the comparative study or analysis that has been done across that argues the 0.5% of the GDP as an appropriate investment to the defense of a country. Here we're talking about the defense of a country. So in that, Chair, I have a difficulty in understanding what informs the sliding scale to 2015-16, and I don't know what happened beyond, because the slide ends there. So I want to say, Chair, that I think that now I was reading, and then there's a perspective that is emerging in terms of what informs this, and I don't know whether I'm correct. The presenter speaks about the Cecil Agostino perspective, which is more like a purely theological approach to some of these issues. Now, I don't know whether this is taking that perspective to its logical conclusion if you look at the author. So, with that, not being privy to it and having had a discussion to engage it, I say, Chair, that I think that we probably will have to have more of the perspective and narratives that can convince me that I must engage with, that the policy as it stands, it needs to basically bring down. In fact, I have a perspective that says, in order for a country to be towards assault, it needs to be sure that it has its own defense. And that means you have to appropriately make sure that you have equipment that protect the country. And I will argue that even I have seen the budget of most countries is at 2% of their GDP in terms of defense, if you're speaking about the defense of the country and nothing else. I want to leave it there, Chair, to say that I don't know whether the committee on the defense itself beside this committee, whether it has ever received a presentation towards the policy direction, redirecting the policy based, of course, with the, what the study would have informed the presenter of the ceasefire campaign. Now, I am also at loss with the ceasefire campaign. Now, if it's a military term, surely the ceasefire should be referring to some degree of war that is taking place. So I'm raising problem with myself and the submission and how it's phrased and what is perspective and the policy. And I'm ending that, probably I ended by saying I don't quite agree. Maybe we, in the future, if we continue to engage and looking at a policy that begins to change, we may be persuaded that yes, the GDP will now have to down up to the 0.5% of the GDP, but that's where I am. I'm at the 2%, and I still argue that at the moment we are not necessarily funding the defense appropriately.
Thank you. We'll note that you're saying so. Okay, I think she will respond. Dr. Rabi has been itching, you know. She's been itching. I don't know.
Chair, I'll be short and sweet. I'd like to agree with Honorable Chairman, with Honorable De Beer. We live in an imperfect world. At the moment, Chairman, we are a member of the BRIC Trade Organization Group. Trade has been threatened in this country by piracy in the Mozambique Channel, which is on our doorstep. We'll have to take proactive measures. We cannot let this go. Chairman, we are a regional power in Africa and so forth. And Chairman, we must remember the Human Science Research Council reported yesterday that more than 1 million people lost their work and so forth. Now, Chairman, with due respect, we can refer to Danielle and these other concerns is that they've got a legacy of the past, but they provide employment to this country, Chairman. They earn foreign revenue to this country. They export and so forth. Chairman, we'll have to put something else in their place. We've got something like almost 40% of the people between 18 and 35 are unemployed in this country, Chairman. But if we can incorporate them, if we can use the military to train these particular people, we can increase, Chairman, and this very morning on the paper they said that something like 60 to almost 70% of our border is unprotected, Chairman. With some of our bordering countries, Chairman, Zimbabwe is not all that cozy. There's a definite possibility that there can be a civil war in Zimbabwe. Swaziland is not all that well enhanced. So, Chairman, we cannot negate the importance of a strong military. It is one, Switzerland, Chairman, which is one of the, and that's also been a neutral country for something like 500 years. They haven't been in a war. But they've got a very, very strong military sort of a defense force and so forth. And that's been their saving grace in the Second World War and so forth. So, Chairman, this is a very complex issue and so forth. And I don't think we'll solve anything by. We're not Costa Rica, Chairman. I mean, you cannot compare us with Costa Rica. It's a small, minute little state in Latin America. We're a regional power. And, Chairman, we'll have to take this very seriously. I've got no mandate for my party, but I think this is rather... we'll have to investigate this and look at the possible consequences to our economy. Thank you, Chairman.
Now, the paper is saying it's not advocating the Costa Rican option. Honorable Swart,
just to add, you know, we not only the pirates that we've got to look at and our trade, but there's also, you know, we as a regional power, we have a responsibility, you know, to look to do peacekeeping missions. We have our navy to protect our coastline, where people are stealing, you know, fish from all over the world. Now we can transfer that function to somebody else, but I mean the money is still going to be spent somewhere, so you know it's silly to say it's got to be taken away from defense. We are in peacekeeping we are at peace at the moment. If we reduce the Defense Force budget, we're going to exacerbate a situation where at present, for instance, we haven't got enough fuel to keep our planes in the air. And because we can't keep our planes in the air, our pilots that have been trained at millions and millions of rands cannot get their licenses sustained because they can't fly enough hours, because we just haven't got the fuel, we haven't got the, you know, we just cannot do it. So how do you reduce the budget and do all these things, you know, in peacetime? Because if it's not peacetime, we're going to have to increase this budget substantially, not decrease it at all.
Honorable Gerard Blanc.
Thank you, Chair. Now, I go through this document, and it is, as the colleagues on both sides said, it is, in the ideal world, a fantastic document. But you know that if you want economic growth, and if you want investors, if you want people who want to come and build industries in this country, they first ask how safe is the country, and how are they protected. So you need a strong economy, as also by colleagues on mentioned earlier here. And then we are regional. We are in South Africa. Many of our soldiers are also doing work in other parts of Africa. But do the honourable or the lady do the presentation here? Do she think? Does she think if she take this document to Britain or to any place in Europe, if they will accept this? And then the other thing is, you must also bear in mind that Africa is not built for sissies. Sorry to make this remark, but it is the reality. Thank you. The question: If you take this to Britain or to any state in Europe, will they look at this or will they accept it? Or what will they do with this document? Now, I said Africa is not built for sissies. Unfortunately, that's the reality. Africa is not for sissies.
I don't understand what you say.
Actually, perhaps if I can say this, I can. To clarify that, Africa is not it is a place where you have a lot of changes take place on a regular basis. So it is not, you know, it is changes in governments take place on a regular basis. And also, if you look at the history of Africa, unfortunately, there is a lot of military interventions. That is the reality. And that is what I mean, actually, with Africa's not processes. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Honorable Billy.
Thanks, Chairperson. I want to quickly go to a sentence. This will forgive me, Chair. This is not numerical, but you will see, I think, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's paragraph number 5. The defense of the nation need not rely on military defense. South Africa knows how to make our country ungovernable. That is a sufficient deterrent to any external force or internal rebel movement against the military overthrow of our democracy. We, Chairperson, if you allow me, we will want to believe that South Africa is at peace with itself. That is what we want to believe here. But we know it is not true. South Africa is not at peace with itself. We come from a past, Chairperson, that tells us that our people out there, they still classify themselves as groupings, small groupings in their little corner. Our people here, some people, some section of our people still believe that yesterday was better than today. Given a chance, we'll do anything to push for that agenda, if you like. Now, what we have not done successfully is to, first and foremost, disarm our nation. We have a lot of arms lying around all over the world. You have the arms unaccounted for, stolen from our military camps. We have not disarmed the groupings of armed forces. I know for one, from where I come from in KZN. So that is a threat to the security of the country. But I want to move by saying, Shepherdson, the reason you have not seen the surgeons of that grouping is because they know that our mighty army is strong. They stand no chance. That is the first point. Now, to suggest at this very early juncture of our democracy that we need to scale down, I think it's mischievous of its worst kind. However, Shepherdson, having listened to the presentation, I'm trying to find myself the relevance of engaging with the document itself at this level. What it seeks to achieve, because the defense mechanism strategy is a policy direction. It's not our terrain. And if somebody here thinks that we have just a smallest power to influence a policy directive at this level regarding the defense of the country. My colleague was saying here because the submission seeks to suggest that the military spending, it's in their thinking that it is to protect the power of the governing elite. You know, I just quite don't agree with this. You know, it's again trying to present a picture which is depicting. You know, I mean we have known what our military defense have done throughout Africa. So I'm trying to wind up, Chairperson, by saying maybe, Chair, in 5 minutes that you gave me, maybe Chairperson, we would have loved to say this document is misplaced. Maybe we need to find a way of engaging with it, but this public platform, I don't understand how is it going to assist us and the presenters or the group themselves to come even to a common understanding about what they seek to achieve by presenting this. Thank you.
Now we invited them. We invited everybody to comment on the MTBS. Others would say the budget is small. Others would say this budget is too much. So I think that they are here in that context. So they have a different view. They are entitled to it. Mamza Nkoyvale, Honourable Yenge.
Thank you, Chair. I will also follow in the same path of my colleagues that there is no committee of parliament that can seek to reduce the budget of the defense force to 0.5. Instead, we want more. The theory that says there should be no state, no police, no defense force. For now, it's still a theory. Even the countries that tried to put that theory into practice, they did not exist for long. And there is no way that we cannot have a defense force. You see, when I look at this presentation, that the terms that are used here, they are used in a different way, because I don't understand, for instance, what is state, what is military security, what's the meaning of military security, because for me, military security means something else. When Comrade Tokyo, I think this is misrepresentation of Comrade Tokyo's use of ceasefire. Comrade Tokyo is a soldier. Ceasefire is a military terminology. And when it's used, they understand. If you use something else instead of ceasefire when they are firing, they're not going to listen to you. Definitely, this content of this document cannot be equated or cannot be derived from what Comrade Tokyo have said on that day. When it comes to Dinel, Comrade Chair, Dinel is not just an asset. A thing to say, Dinel is not an asset. I don't want to say it's naive or naivety, but Dinel is not just an asset, but Dinel is the strategic asset of the country. The fact that Roy Falk did not do much money as we expected, but the fact that in this country we have expertise that can or that could brought into being a commodity of that nature, we must be applauded, because not any African country can manage to do what our own people did by manufacturing that asset. I don't want to talk much because really I don't understand the simple language. I don't want to be harsh, because the more I'll be criticizing this document, I'll be very harsh. Yeah, and I think it's enough for me to say this, but the whole content of this document really it does not understand why there are military in the whole world. So with those few words, Chair, I thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I think that we have heard the comments, but I just want to protect the ceasefire campaign again, to say when we invite the public, we invite them to come and express their views. Sometimes they may agree or disagree, and I think that this is the forum that they have to express their views, obviously. But I think that I there are proposals for this, and I don't know, Mr. Bobcat. Someone said maybe the document, because I clearly
policy, what you call it, proposals, rather than proposals for which we could be clearly defined in terms of a budget. Maybe we could try to afford you guys another platform to deal with this. You did mention that there would be a defense review. Maybe it could be much, much better be dealt with at those levels, you know. But at this committee, I want to say here's a budget proposal by the executive. What is your view? Hence the invitation to yourselves. I think we welcome the views both sides, but the committee will deliberate in terms of what is it that they think that is acceptable to them or not. So don't feel intimidated. Feel comfortable. You may respond.
You were saying?
Okay. Well, firstly, it saddens me that there is a very closed perspective here in this room on this whole issue. And I first want to say that mothballing does not mean doing away with the defense force. It means that what you do is you maintain it, you make sure that the soldiers are paid, you maintain your weapons, but it doesn't become a massive focus. And what we're saying is that development growth is not indicated by the gross domestic product and the percentage of gross domestic product that goes to defense. That's what we're trying to say. And so we're not suggesting that there is no military. My organization has members that are total pacifists and has members that understand that there has to be an army. So it has members from across the board, and this represents a view from both sides. We all believe demilitarization itself means that the military plays a lesser role in our lives. We would never have had the arms deal and the abysmal waste of money if the Hawks had not had that input to that. But of course we will hear when we see the Commission of Inquiry, because one of the terms of reference is to say, did we really need that arms deal when we needed houses? We are still living in a totally unequal society. So demilitarization does not necessarily mean do away with everything. What we're saying is there should be more emphasis on other things. Yes, I think just generally I want to also elaborate a bit more on ceasefire, and we certainly would not say that Tokyo has had anything to do with this organization. It was just that after he said those words, we were talking about what we could call this organization, and somebody said ceasefire, and they mentioned, we mentioned this issue at the funeral. Our first campaign was use the ballot, not the bullet. And that's what we've been working on ever since. We monitor the National Conventional Arms Control Committee. We participate in international campaigns that are against arms. We are also, we work with government in terms of trying to get finally some legislation passed on cluster munitions, for example. We were very active in the anti-landmines campaign. We are not just an organization who suddenly decided that we want to oppose the use of the army. So we've got a long history. We've been in existence since 1993. Most of us were anti-apartheid activists. We've got a large percentage of youth who are with us now who we provide with peace education so that they do have a different mindset as well. Just on the issue of this, I'm absolutely staggered that people talk about destabilization within the country. That is an even greater argument for more money to be spent on the needs of the people than on an army. No matter what anybody says, the service delivery protests, whatever you want to call them, they are an indication that that we have not managed to do what the policies, and I absolutely agree with the policies, that we have to make sure that we have a more equitable society. We certainly have not suggested for 1 minute that we don't have police. Don't know where you got that from. In fact, we were arguing that perhaps more money should go to the police. And also, we don't, thank goodness, South Africa doesn't look to Europe for inspiration for certain things. I think it's in a damn mess myself right now. Thank God our financial situation is far better than most of Europe's. So I think, we wouldn't look to Europe for that. And I think we need to talk also about Denel at some point, and we will. Denel is a capital-intensive structure. It is not offering thousands and thousands of jobs to people. Please don't be deceived. Look at the details and find out what it's all about. It doesn't offer great employment to people. What it does is take mine and your money to support, to keep it afloat. And we must also think that, talking about the need to maintain an army, I mean, the biggest budget allocation in the world is America. And that is because it has an aggressive posture. We don't have an aggressive posture. We don't need enormous budgets. So even if you don't agree with me that we should eventually taper it off to 0.5%, we can certainly say that we want to keep it where it is and make better use of the money that we have got, making sure it is of tremendous concern that the weapons are not kept properly. It is tremendous concern. I read the other day that some soldiers who were promised to be incorporated into the SANDF weren't. And then you think, well, do we need all these soldiers? What do we need? What do we need? I'm sorry, there's some other things I would like to talk about, but we can go on quite a lot. This is a hawkish council of people, and the ideas that we are putting forward are new, perhaps, and maybe you need to just consider them and think about a different approach. And it's not to be closed to the ideas that are in this document, some of which might be radical, some of which are things that we all fought for.
Thank you. You're done?
I'm sure there are other things I could argue about, but I won't.
Sure. No, thank you very much.
And by the way, thank you for giving me all those questions. I never thought I would get them.
Just a small clarity, Chair, so that it's possible that we misunderstand the content and the presentation, because we really don't understand. The questions might be it's because we don't understand. Now I need clarity. If when you say certain tasks that are currently undertaken by the SANDF should be demilitarized, you said it as which task exactly? You are saying you want the military to exist, but certain tasks that are performed by the SANDF should not be done. I'm saying SANDF. There's no way that I can make that mistake. Never. It's SANDF. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, talk to, because I'm protest me, Chair. Just protest me. I'm on the floor. Yeah. So what I'm asking, which task that should be performed by SANDF, which should not be performed and should be performed? Exactly, so that we understand. I'm sure once we understand, I think we are misunderstanding you. because we don't understand exactly what you are talking about. But immediately you just point out the task of the SANDF that needs to be demilitarized or not to be performed by them, and those that you think must remain with them, that will be fine. But also I would want you to explain to us, what do you mean when you say that DINEL does not employ people? All it, I maybe I misunderstood you. Please, I need to be protected. Madam, when you are on the floor, please share. When we are on the floor, we allow the lady to speak. We, you know, never make any body language, because immediately we make a body language, it sends different messages. You never know what it means. So please, I just want to understand those two questions. Because if DINEL only takes money from the taxpayers, from me and from us and her, what then that money does? Are there no people? Is are the poorest of the poor really not benefiting? Should we talk about the degrees of benefiting, or should we say that they are not benefiting at all?
Well, thank you very much. Honourable members, I
in
really,
point of
really,
order, Chair.
It's 11 o'clock
in
now.
Point of order, Chair. Point of order.
Point of order.
Yes,
for
Chair.
Me, I've said nothing.
No. I want to engage on this discussion, and it is a point of order in that, Chair, because you have not even heard me. I'm saying, Chairperson,
you have not been heard.
No. My point of order, Chair. I'm saying, Chairperson, maybe you should have explained to the presenter that in any event we are in Parliament. This is Parliament. So in Parliament we behave in a certain manner. You don't. There are things traditionally that you don't do. Otherwise, it's going to upset the whole thing. I mean, it was nice and everything, but you don't behave in a certain manner in Parliament. It is not done, and you are not going to tolerate it. Maybe you should have explained that this is Parliament. It's not just a push hearing. We are in Parliament. We should behave parliamentary manner. It's done in that way. Maybe you should have explained that to the President as well.
Now, I've protected you. I've protected Honor being in. I've addressed that everyone must address one another through me. Honourable Mashiru, I really, really want to close this matter.
Yeah, thanks, Chairperson. I think
I'm sure. Listen, comrade, you're going to be short, ne?
Yeah.
Please.
Always, I'm short, sir. I may look very tall, but I'm short.
I don't think so.
Yeah, James. What I actually just wanted to raise is that the presenter not to be agitated, because the presenter is making proposals which they wish to see happen. But when we don't agree as members of parliament, we must say so. So that, you know, they cannot go home thinking that the proposals they've made sense and they've been accepted, when we have got different views. So we must raise the different views, and we must actually also reject the views on the basis that the reasonings that we have made. Chair, as I've indicated, is that the presentation seeks to simplify a complex situation, which is not correct. That is the message that one just wanted to give, that it can't be correct, it is not correct, and it is not going to be correct to simplify a complex matter and make proposals that looks like implementing a research outcome. Some sort of a research outcome or is a study or whatever, because, you know, proposals should be informed by real information that people can verify and say this is acceptable because it is done X, Y, Z. But the proposals that have been made here, Chair, really
I have reservations because they really look like we are testing something, and we cannot test with military protection. Thank you.
Now, please, honourable members, I think that we, I think we have expressed our views, and clearly, what we are saying now, things that we have said before. I think that it's clear. I wanted her to close that time. I thought that she was making closing remarks, but you might want to react to anything that has been said.
I think that I must respond to
the question. Yes, so it's clear what you call the question. So. The second one was whether Danelle, you gave the impression that Danelle is not employing people.
Okay.
Maybe at the scale that is being said.
Yeah. Okay. Because I didn't come here to talk about Danelle, I can't give you figures off the top of my head. But certainly top and middle management are the majority of Danelle staff. And as far as I'm concerned, and this has been documented, a lot of the Danelle companies do not treat their staff particularly well, especially those who work in ammunition factories and things like that. And anyway, that's I did not say that they don't employ people, but it is a capital-intensive industry, and I'm not so sure it is a great asset in that way. Just with regard to functions, for example, you might find that local Coast Guard would be better than spending too much money on the Navy, and it is a policing function, not so much as a military function. That it would then have. That's just one example. Also, providing education to young people. We would rather see young people trained in different fields within different departments, within, for example, agriculture, or within educational health. Why must they go to the Defence Force to gain these skills? It's just a way of thinking that is different. I hope I've answered your question. And I certainly didn't mean to offend anybody here.
Earlier you had made your concluding remarks. We're closing.
No, I'm finished now.
Okay. Message off. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Polakett, for coming and presenting to the committees. We have heard your views, but obviously I think the last input you were saying, clearly it looks like there is a particular view. But now really the purpose of this session is to listen to people, not to take decisions. We'll take our own time when you're not here. To the purpose of the session is really for you to allow you to make your submission and get clarity, and then we'll take a decision as I indicated earlier. But also to say that we don't get under any if perhaps the message that you got was that we don't recognize the role played by organization, maybe your predecessor, and conscription, what you call a campaign. I think that nobody is questioning the credentials of conscription campaign. But as I indicated, that this is a policy matter, maybe that this to be discussed at that level. So I think there will be a different opportunities. Somebody spoke about the portfolio committee, for instance, where matters of defense are, which has a focus on those matters. Ours is just to look at the budget of defense. But I'm not saying that you're not welcome to make a presentation, but all that we're saying is that there it could be much, much be broader, what you call entertained. As I mean, clearly, the questions were indicating that direction, that it's a matter that would need a broader, what you call we're not dismissing the presentation. But thank you very much for coming. You may sit. You're welcome to sit with us. But thank you very much. We're done. Now, my colleague, Honorable Chane, will take over the chairing. Salga, in terms of this program, was supposed to be here, and they are not. Or somebody is hiding himself that side. I think that will give Salga the opportunity, but I must give to what you call. I say that I'm giving to Honorable Chane to share. Honorable Chane, over to you.
Thank you, Chair. All members, without waste of time, let me take Salga. I don't know if you're going to be using the screens, or if that is the case, may you come here, please. Introduce yourself and present.
Good morning, Chairperson. Thank you for the opportunity. Please allow me to make a sincere apology. I arrived late for the meeting, and maybe on behalf of our political representation, our Chairperson of the Municipal Finance Working Group had to attend by-elections today in her municipality, so unfortunately we don't have political representation at the meeting.
Is it the manifest that I'll tell the
Thank you very much, Chairperson. We've compiled some comments with respect to
there's
the
just hold on, EPS. Sir. Just hold on. Honourable Rashid.
Yeah, Chairperson, you see, I think we just need to understand this clearly, you see. Salga, I think, his leadership are councillors, Chairperson. And one needs to know exactly whether the view that we're going to get there is the view of that leadership, you know. Because, I mean, you know, officials are officials. You know, they can just run amok and present all sorts of things to everywhere, but without the necessary authority. In which situation are we finding ourselves? Because, you know, given there's so many councillors that we have elected in May, and there's so many councillors that are just around us here in Cape Town City, but then we find ourselves in that situation where you don't have... we can call it the political leadership of Salga. Can one just get some reasonable clarity on that message? Thanks.
But I'm sure that won't stop us from proceeding, but I will allow him to explain and proceed. Just clarify that and proceed, man.
Thank you. I think it's unfortunate that we could not secure a councillor for this the meeting. It's a very important meeting. We first of all, tried our chairperson of the finance working group in Salga, which is at the moment a temporary arrangement until the Salga NEC Lekgotla, which is due next week, will finalize appointments for working group chairs. And so we are in an interim period at the moment, which makes it a bit difficult to secure representation at this stage.
I think the question was whether you are fully mandated to make this presentation by organization. That's the heart of the question.
Chairperson, certainly from the administrative side, I can confirm that I'm mandated to make the presentation.
Can you proceed?
Thank you. With respect to the economic outlook, Salga notes the need, the dire situation in the economy at the moment, as well as what is projected over the medium-term expenditure framework, as well as the required fiscal prudence that is required from all government spheres that is noted by Salga. However, the slowing economy, Chairperson, will also affect local government revenues and therefore service delivery in municipalities. We do agree with the broad statement in the MTPPS that calls for moderation in public spending, and therefore municipalities should also reprioritize their budgets and with specific focus towards more investment in infrastructure. We do note the commitment in the MTPPS towards protecting the baseline allocations for local government that were made in previous medium-term expenditure frameworks. And in that regard, we welcome the 5 billion rand added to the expenditure framework for 2012. However, with respect to the broader review of the local government fiscal framework that is underway, Salga believes that there is a need for empirical studies into the actual cost of service delivery in local government, and that should inform the basis for the vertical division of revenue between the three spheres of government. We are saying that those studies should underpin the local government fiscal review. Specific comments with respect to the equitable share. We note the 2.2 billion rand that is added over the MTEF. Our observation is that it is, however, less than 10% increase. The increase is less than 10% of the total local government equitable share allocation. These increases are therefore observed as a pass on of cost in relation to salaries and bulk services. Meaning that especially for smaller municipalities that are highly reliant on funding from the national government, that there is no net increase in the budgets of such municipalities, especially if you consider the cost of governance and administration as well. We believe that the rising cost of bulk services and the demand for basic services require higher than inflation increases to the equitable share. Municipalities are struggling to provide for repairs and maintenance of the infrastructure through which free basic services are delivered to the poor. And therefore, the maintenance cost of the infrastructure is quite exponential. It's quite high, and therefore the equitable share needs to assist the municipalities with that. The basic services provision is gradually becoming unaffordable to municipalities, Chairperson. I think that's an important point to note, that households are becoming more and more, or they are exposed to huge pressure from these increases in services, as well as the municipalities at the end of the day, when it comes to the payment of those services. Salga notes that there is a review of the equitable share formula underway. We do participate in the process very actively. And We note that this process should result in a more equitable distribution of the funds between the municipalities based on their varying fiscal capacities. Other things that we foresee should come out of the review is that a new poverty line should be used to determine the number of poor households targeted through the equitable share, and also that the basket of basic services that is covered should be broadened to include other services such as firefighting and stormwater drainage systems. Again, especially for your small municipalities that are highly reliant on funding from the fiscus. And then more funding towards rural municipalities. With respect to conditional grants, we note the 2.8 billion rand for direct transfers to municipalities and the 994 million rand for indirect transfers. These, as we have seen, are prioritized towards upgrading of informal settlements in cities and large towns, but also for bulk infrastructure and solid waste management in rural municipalities. SALGA, as the budget process unfolds further, would like to support additions with respect to integrated bulk raw water storage facilities to support service delivery in rural municipalities. Funding for roads infrastructure management capacity in rural municipalities, as well as targeted support towards the improvement of capacity in rural municipalities, such as the initiative that is currently work in progress or underway with respect to the urban municipalities under the Urban Settlements Development Grant. Then municipalities need to be better capacitated to plan and execute projects funded through the conditional grants. Chairperson, we've listed other matters that SALGA basically took to the recent budget forum with the Minister of Finance, and I'm listing some of these issues. The issue of unfunded mandates, the FFC in its submission for the 2012-13 Division of Revenue has estimated the extent of the unfunded mandates in metros to be approximately 4 billion rand per annum. We are saying that national government should start addressing this issue in the next budget. We've also raised in the budget forum the issue of some ad hoc national policies and legislative amendments that are constraining own revenue sustainability for municipalities. One of the examples, and this is what some of the matters have raised, is the issue of ARTO. That is not functional at the moment, and it costs money for the municipalities. There are issues with respect to the implementation of rates, ratios, regulations of the Municipal Property Rates Act, where again some of the municipalities are actually just losing money. NERSA tariff processes are not always aligned to the MFMA budget process, and these cause quite a bit of problems for municipalities when implementing their budgets. With respect to the payment of property rates by national and provincial government, we say that national and provincial government should commit to pay the outstanding property rates. We also note that there are processes underway from national government to address the issue, but we think it can be expedited. There is an issue with respect to data from property data from the deeds office that municipalities feel that if it is provided free of charge, it will actually enhance their ability to improve the integrity of their billing systems to a greater extent than what is currently possible. And this will also assist them in that area towards achieving clean audits. In conclusion, Chairperson, SALGA acknowledges the tight fiscal stance amid the national and global economic challenges. And SALGA will impress upon its members to redirect spending towards frontline services as required in the MTBPS and to reduce non-COIN ineffective expenditure. Two of the ways that we see we can do it, or vehicles available to South at the moment, is we host on an annual basis budget week workshops, and we will be hosting that from the end of this month over the next couple of months as municipalities prepare for their 2012-13 budget. We will also communicate in financial circulars to municipalities to remind them of the importance of redirecting spending towards frontline services and to reduce non-COIN ineffective expenditure. Then lastly, Chairperson, with respect to the protection of municipal revenues, this is again what we recommended to the Budget Forum, was that National Treasury must develop a framework of revenue management that is applicable to all policy and legislative impacts on local government revenues. This framework should include a compulsory assessment of the implementation costs and also to revisit these costs after 2 years of implementation in case any unintended consequences were omitted. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Salga. Honourable members, any questions for clarity on the report? Dr. Ravi, Mr. Swart, and Mr. Decker. Mr. Mashiri, be the last.
Chair, on the, I think the second last page, in his submission, he says that national and provincial governments must commit to pay outstanding property rights to municipalities. Now, Chairman, this is not acceptable. I'm sure the provincial governments and the national government should set an example, especially to smaller, vulnerable municipalities. Is it possible to give this committee an indication how much is still outstanding from property rights from the respective sort of provincial governments and the national government? Because that must have an adverse effect on the cash flow of these municipalities. I'd like to get the views of the Speaker, and if he can't give it, I think if he can respond to it in writing, it could be to the advantage of the committee chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Swan, Honourable Swan.
Thank you, Chair. You know, the question of regional electricity distributors' rates, for a number of years, it was mooted that the rates were going to take over the distribution networks of municipalities, and it was quite a number of years that this whole thing went on. And during that period, municipalities didn't spend any money on the maintenance of the networks, the result being that those networks are really deteriorated during that period. Now rates have been abandoned, and it's the correct decision to abandon them. They should never have started in the first place. But, you know, is there any way in which government should be helping or assisting municipalities to get those distribution networks properly maintained again?
Mr. Bezo?
Chairman, I don't know if I'm in the correct podium, but you can overrule me otherwise. But I'm worried about if in a normal situation this... this would be a very good presentation, but I don't think that there's a normal condition in local government. And if you visit all the municipalities and you look at the amounts that are wasteful expenditure, that money that disappear with corruption, I like to hear what Salga, as our representative of the municipalities intend to do about it.
Honourable Machina.
Yeah, Chair. I'm still tempted, Chair, to really say that I've got a feeling that really we are engaging with this document that doesn't have authority. I still have that feeling, Chair. And that the content of this report here, I don't think that Salga can own it. The leadership of Salga will own it, Chair. Especially after getting the comment that says they're still going to put structures, you know, it's in some Lokhotla sometimes. Therefore, that means there is no subcommittee of finance that has actually sanctioned the content of this particular report. And therefore, I really believe that should not engage this report. It's, Chair, I think I've just raised my... Because we need to engage a report with people that when they go back, whatever we have raised then must find expression back there, but not something that other people that are supposed to take decisions may refuse to own it. You know, it's as I'm seeing, and the explanation that we have got is that this is a report of the officials of SARCA, of the officials, and therefore yeah, I've got reservations, Chair. Thank you very much.
No, it's fine. Let me just note your reservations, but I don't think it would be fair that you speak for SARCA. Let SARCA speak for itself. If at the later stage they've got an issue with this submission, they will take it with their own official. But for now, I would want us to concentrate on the questions as raised. Do you want to raise a question, Mr. Marshall? I will see you. Okay, proceed.
During this presentation, there's something that maybe I don't understand very well, because they talk about capacitation that has to be done. But I think this is part of what SARCA should be doing. They should be telling us how far they have gone and what causes them not to be able to execute projects funded through conditional grants, because they say on a certain page that municipalities must be better capacitated to plan and execute projects funded through conditional grants. Because I think when they are aware of what specific purposes those grants are for, and if they don't plan for those grants, and that money is being transferred specifically for those purposes, and we still have statements that refer to municipalities must train, when I think is the role of SARCA in consultation with other departments to make sure, because we can't be sitting here talking about IDIP every day. What is that? Development Bank, which we know that they're supposed to be assisting, because when National Treasury comes, it tells us about those capacities. When SARCA comes, it still tells us about to capacitate. Then we find ourselves in a position of, is this grant really serving a purpose to the people that we as Parliament and the people who are going to pass this division of revenue think that is going to serve the purpose of benefiting the people out there? But the people who should be executing this duty of making sure that the grants are being spent, because they are conditional for those specific purposes, are not being spent. We ask ourselves about the relevance of those grants, conditional grants, that they get, but they remain not spent, and the reason being the same each and every year. So we ask ourselves, what goes wrong? What makes them stop and not being spent? And something that I didn't understand, and maybe I'll understand one day, is this direct and indirect transfers. Because 1 minute indirect is to me is sometimes augmented by the direct, but the presentation seems to be saying, no, those people just help and leave whatever infrastructure they've provided with us. But I wish I could get clarity or know exactly how, where they meet and where they don't meet? Because sometimes when this one goes up, the other one goes down. Then you ask yourself whether one is not augmenting the other. Thank you.
Honorable Matlakane and Honorable Sintle.
No, thank you, Chairperson. I think that I've got two questions. But I was just worried about that point that was not developed about the status of document, but I'll leave that. I just want to understand the empirical study. What is behind the word? The document suggests that for service delivery cost, there should be empirical studies that is done. Now, I just want to understand what is it that has been argued here. Is it the argument that at the moment there's a thumbsuck in terms of the service delivery and the budget that goes into it, and therefore the contestation that comes into being is that it's ill-informed, it's not necessarily addressing what's supposed to be addressed. I just want to understand what this means. I want to understand that because I know that there's been lots of Treasury has been doing lots and lots of studies and lots and lots of that informed behind what is behind the budget at the end. So what is this, Chair? I just want to understand what it is. The second question is on the following slide. There is something that is said that the whole equitable share distribution, that it should be informed by fiscal capacities of municipality. The distribution should vary based on the fiscal capacity. Now, I don't understand as well what it means. If it could be explained, is it behind the words that says that if municipality A, where there is a fire burning because of the lack of service delivery, and they don't necessarily the capacity in terms of its own as municipality for functionality, including the management of finances, is a bit shaky, that the money should be then redirected to Cape Town, because Cape Town fiscal capacity is better, and therefore it's basically redirecting the money. I just want to understand what it means by this. What informs this kind of perspective? Where does it derive that authority? Where does it come from? Where is this? Because in terms of allocation of money, there's law that says in terms of this is how we talking about equitable distributions and the proportions. There's informed behind it. There's numbers. There's head count. There's all this thing that informs us. So why introducing? I just want to understand the also behind this sentence, because there's probably lot behind it, Chair. There is one or two, but I think it's already been asked the question of indirect and so on, but I'm not going to go into that. I just want to understand the two, because I think probably in understanding the two, we understand the thrust of the presentation. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just for the record, I'm standing in for my colleague, Honorable Makubela, that is not too well. Chair, I've got two issues. The first one is to do with this juncture with NERSA. What would SALGA recommend that from a legislative framework Parliament does to address that whole issue? I serve on the energy cluster and so on, and one of the serious challenges that, for instance, the Department of Energy is experiencing is that money has been transferred for some of these issues that's been raised, like your electrification and so on, and municipalities, for reasons of their own, don't use that money. And it's not small change, it's millions of rands that's lying there that's not being used. So the first issue that I want to raise is at this juncture with NERSA and what we can do, and secondly, what about the money that's lying at municipalities that's there for specific purposes and not being used? Then secondly, Chair, I don't know, maybe the officials of the Department of Treasury can assist me. There was money appropriated now for the councillors that weren't re-elected in the May election. I can't find the figure now, but it's quite a substantial amount. What is the process, and is SALGA involved in that process of making sure that those councillors that are supposed to get that gratuity of 3 months will get it very soon? It seems to me that it might be quite a drawn-out process, and I don't think that was the intention when that gratuity was announced by the President.
Salga, you may respond. I know that some of the issues raised there are not necessarily speaking to the police itself as it stands before us. Honorable Snell.
Thank you, Chairperson. I don't know if Salga will be able to answer, so maybe FFC, but I'll place my question. You can rule me out, Chair. With us having a unitary state, but with each sphere being having its own competencies, national government has seen it prudent to be able to borrow up to 40% of GDP to be able to achieve its development goals and to put in a counter-cyclical budget. Now, the local government ability to borrow would be directly proportional to the income that they can generate. And what would that be capped at, even if you were allowed to borrow up to, say, 40% of your revenue collections? Is it capped at anything less than that, or is the 40% or is the increase that has been increase in borrowing from the from national government, has those inflows come into local government to be able to help you achieve your developmental goals that would then tie into provincial and national government's objectives, or do you find yourselves hamstrung in the manner in which regulations, constitutional issues are currently structured, and how do you think you could improve that? Thank you.
Salga.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, there are some of the questions that I think we need to respond in writing, as I think we need a better informed response to them. And I think there are some of the responses that even my colleagues from the Treasury and the FFC can assist in enhancing and understanding. But with respect to the extent of outstanding property rates due to municipalities by national and provincial government, I understand that that proportion still needs to be determined. There are issues. In fact, I've seen a document developed between National Treasury and Department of Cooperative Governance that started to address this issue of outstanding debt, or specifically property rates to municipalities. So that number, unfortunately, I don't have a direct or clear number at the moment. So we will, as the Member of Parliament suggested, that we provide that response in writing, we will do so. On the issue of the REITs, I think the question was whether municipalities would need assistance to invest in electricity infrastructure. My understanding of the, or my limited understanding, if I should say that correctly, of the electricity distribution industry is that the municipalities do generate quite a lot of surpluses from this function, and you would expect municipalities to be able to invest from those proceeds on their own in electricity infrastructure. But national government also provide conditional grants for under the Integrated National Electrification Program to assist municipalities in investing in electricity infrastructure. On the issue of money disappearing in municipal budgets, how will SALGA address this? If my understanding of the question or the comment is correct, at the moment what SALGA is able to do is to, as I presented earlier, is to impress upon our municipalities, our members, to improve their budgeting processes. How we do this is through our budget weeks. We create a platform for municipalities to share best practices, and it's certainly something that we need to do more often with municipalities. As in the past, we mostly focused on revenue management issues, but the issue of seeking efficiencies in the expenditure needs to be emphasized in our engagements with municipalities. But we will do that through our engagements with the municipalities in the budget weeks. On the question about whether the submission has been mandated by SALGA, I don't have a direct answer on that, Chairperson. As I indicated earlier, unfortunately, we could not secure a politician to represent us today. But I will definitely refer this to our executive, and then it will be escalated to the chairperson as well. There was a question about what is SALGA done to capacitate municipalities on the spending of conditional grants. I think there should be an understanding of the ability of SALGA to support its municipalities. At the moment, as I said, these platforms that we create is to some extent the best support mechanism that we can provide to municipalities, and that is where we provide a platform for municipalities to engage each other on best practice, but also to invite different other stakeholders to assist in capacitating municipalities on how to improve on on certain matters. We from time to time work together with national departments responsible for these grants to seek ways of assisting municipalities. I can mention the one instance, I think it was in 2009 when National Treasury required municipalities to revert unspent funding back to the national fiscus. SALGA supported that. That is one of the ways that we try to emphasize the importance of compliance to various legislation. But the issue of capacity, I think, it's quite critical, and it's quite a complex issue to address over a short period of time. With respect to the difference in direct and indirect grants, I said my colleagues at Treasury can give a very good explanation about this, but my understanding is that direct grants, it's clear it's directly transferred to municipalities in their primary bank accounts, and the municipalities have to implement the conditions with which the funding comes to them. On with respect to indirect grants, these grants are basically transferred from the fiscus to mainly national departments that implement infrastructure projects on behalf of municipalities that have limited capacity to do so. And funding is also indirectly provided to ESCOM for, providing the rollout of electricity infrastructure in areas where ESCOM is responsible for that, as well as where municipalities don't have the capacity to do so. On the issue of what we mean with empirical studies to inform the review of the fiscal framework, Chairperson, our understanding is that the, and this is to some extent a bit technical with respect to the equitable share at the moment, there are basic services costs estimates used in determining the allocations to municipalities that was basically a fundamental determination was done in 2004. Some updates have been done since that over the last few years, but we think that there needs to be a thorough empirical study to inform that, and that at the end of the day needs to inform back to decisions around the vertical division of revenue, which we understand is a political process in the budget process. But we feel that whatever decisions are taken there needs to be taken on the basis of best available information. And then there was a question about what is meant by the fiscal capacity of municipalities. I hope I will be quoting the local government budgets and expenditure review correctly, which basically outlined what is meant by the fiscal capacity of municipalities. And just to mention that it basically emanates from, the powers and functions that the municipalities have and the basic ability that gives to municipality to raise revenue on their own. That basically underscores the fiscal capacity of municipalities. And this varies across municipalities, across the country. And that is what we meant that, the equitable share review should take that into consideration. At the moment, it does take that into consideration because it adheres to the, I think it's section 214 of the Constitution that also requires the equitable share to take into consideration the fiscal capacity of municipalities. But I think just to make the last point around the fiscal capacity, I think there has been some developments with respect to the structure of municipalities and in future there will be some amendments to some of the powers and functions of municipalities, and we foresee that as those amendments are being made, as it affects the fiscal capacity of municipalities, that needs to be addressed as well. What to do about the NERSA, the disjuncture of the NERSA tariff policy process with the MFMA budget process? I'm not clear with respect to the legislative, I think that was the question, proposals that can be made around that. And I suggest, Chair, on that specific one that we respond in writing that. There has been a suggestion by the budget forum that we should get together with stakeholders around the budget forum on this issue, and if it's merely an administrative issue of engaging NERSA directly to identify some of the challenges in their processes for municipalities, then we need to address that in such a forum. on the process of the payment of gratuity payments to councillors. Chairperson, again on that one, we will respond in writing to the committee on that one. And on the issue, the last issue on as the borrowing of national government assisted municipalities, I think it's quite a complex situation, but I think we've indicated in our response that the medium-term expenditure framework provides at least protects the baseline allocations made to municipalities or indicated in previous medium-term expenditure frameworks. And to some extent, I cannot say whether there's a direct link between national borrowing and the provision of fiscal support to municipalities through that. But certainly the budget allows that kind of protection to the allocations of municipalities. On the side of municipalities with respect to borrowing, I think some of our metros who are and some of the secondary cities who are the largest borrowers in local government have borrowed to a large extent. To what percentage they are geared up on an average level, I'm not exactly sure, but some of these municipalities have quite substantial exposure to capital markets. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, can we agree, because some of the questions that you are raising, you refer to the FFC being the relevant institution to respond to. We are pressed for time. We've got only 1 hour left, and FFC has two. I note some limitations in terms of the responses from SAWDA, so can we agree that we allow the FFC to present, and perhaps in their presentation there will be that attempt to address some of your questions. And with regard to SAWDA, then we should agree that your written submissions will be before Friday, meaning by close of business tomorrow. Thank you. National Treasury, you will comment later. Let's take the FFC. Thank you very much. Let me indicate, honourable member, some of us will be hearing the presentation for a second time. So that will be an opportunity to clarify whatever that was not clear when the first submission was made, and others will be hearing it for the first time. Given that it's a joint sitting, but we'll be on closing this meeting just before 1 o'clock. Mr. Kumalo.
Oh, thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Because you have indicated
Chairperson, I don't understand the reason for the meeting. I don't understand why do people have to present and then no questions, no clarities are asked from them. Is it because of time?
Which one then are you referring to specifically?
So there's SALCA.
SALCA, they presented allowed questions and honorable members raised questions and clarities.
What if there were clarities?
Come again?
What if there were people who want to engage further on it?
I did not get any indication from honorable members, for sure.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Thanks, ma'am.
Okay, no, I was saying thank you, Chairperson. And as you have already indicated, we are actually doing this presentation for the third time. But fortunately, because we have a base document from which we are working, we have tried to tailor make it to suit a particular committee. So some of the things that we might not have talked to that are in the written submission might actually be coming out today and might not have come out in the other two presentations that we've already made. I think in terms of today's presentation, I will we will basically address four key areas. Briefly on the macroeconomic and fiscal framework outlook, then we look at the medium-term budget policy statement, spending priorities, and then we look at the issues of the division of revenue over the 2012 MTF and focusing on the adjustments to provincial and local government allocations. And then we will make some conclusions there. I think in terms of a background, it has been very clear in the past presentations that from where we sit as a commission, we agree with the fiscal policy stance that government has taken. And we also are noting that in terms of our expectations for this period, starting from 2008, basically, we are looking at the impact of the global economic crisis that is closer to the severe impact as opposed to the business as usual impact, which basically means that the position that takes a fiscal stance that is a tight one, fiscal consolidation specifically, needs to also be looked at in terms of how we then also try and cushion the poor. And in terms of that cushioning, there's quite a number of programs that we actually have that have not been functioning efficiently. So the message in terms of the theme of our submission is still the same, and we actually find resonance in what is contained in the MTBBS to quite a large extent. Now, let me just say at this point, let me allow my two co-presenters, basically Dr. Ramos Mabugu, who is the director of the research program at the Commission, and Mr. Teboho Makube, who is the senior program manager in the fiscal policy unit of the Commission, to take you through the presentation. Dr. Mpo.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I'll speak to starting with the macroeconomic issues and priorities. And I think as the Acting Chair has pointed out, in terms of the overall macroeconomic outlook, little has changed over the past year. And in fact, our economy is still very vulnerable to interruptions, especially in the global economy. And as a result of this vulnerability, we see downward revisions in 2011 gross domestic product figures by government, the Reserve Bank, and other international institutions such as the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. Furthermore, the sectoral composition of output has also come under pressure due to slow recovery of our main trading partners. And we have already seen a decline in manufacturing and also as well as retail and motor trade and accommodation, which are not only the largest contributors to output, but also comprise the country's major exports. Moving on to the slide on consolidation, as the chairperson pointed out, we think now more than ever the issue of fiscal consolidation is of utmost importance for South Africa. And what has now come on the table compared to the submission we made last year on 2010 MTBPS is the trend that we're beginning to see of shooting up of debt service costs. And what these imply in the long term would be that they may start eating into service delivery. as well as your co-investment function. So there's a need to watch the debt service issue, debt service cost aspect of the debt dynamics, as well as the sharp increase that we have seen in foreign indebtedness, although the share of foreign indebtedness remains small, but it's something that has suddenly shot up. So with those two perspectives in mind, we think the two committees need to keep a close eye on the debt situation. Moving on to the next slide, in terms of medium-term spending priorities, the issue of job creation is at the forefront again, much as it was last year. And what's different in terms of the 2011 MTBPS compared to 2010 MTBPS is the priority shift in government expenditure towards infrastructure investment as a critical vehicle for job creation. So the other things we saw last year, issues of the jobs fund that was announced by the president in the State of Nation address, as well as allocations for industrial development corporation, etc., stay as vehicles for job creation. But what we see in the 2011 MTBPS, that's special, is that distinct shift towards capital expenditures as a major vehicle for job creation. And from the commission side, we think this is a welcome priority shift, and it's in line with our 2011 recommendation on the division of revenue for next year. And we do find that if a capital expenditure program is well executed, it does tend to grow the economy. And given the structure of the economy, it also does create jobs. But the key word is that it has to be carefully and well executed. And the issues that members were raising in terms of IT, etc., are issues that need to be tightened for that infrastructure spending to bear fruit. Then another issue around medium-term spending priorities are issues around health and millennium development goals. And the issue that we want to raise from the Commission is the slow progress in achieving the millennium development goals that speak to health, in particular child and maternal mortality, as well as the AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria, and other diseases. That's your MDG6. We are so far away from where we agreed as a country to be in 2015. And so what the Commission recommended this year in terms of its recommendations for the submission of the Division of Revenue Bill was actually in line with what we see in the 2011 MTBPS, which is a reprioritization forcefully towards primary health care, as well as addressing issues of HIV/AIDS in terms of widening the CD4 count for which people can get antiretroviral treatment. And the reason why we recommended this is because we identified two causes of maternal and child deaths in the country. And those had to do with the issue of AIDS, as well as the issue that we picked up, that most of the people that are now dying are actually dying in care. In other words, in hospitals, clinic, etc., as opposed to dying outside of the care system. So if you address the quality of care inside care institutions, you are going to make an impact on the number of mothers and children that are going to die. So we are happy with that two-pronged approach towards
moving towards the health goals. And we do find that addressing the HIV AIDS goal in particular does crowd in or has a developmental impact in that it pulls other development indicators along with it, such as MDG 4 and MDG 5. And we also advocate for MDG 2, the Universal Primary Education, which again is prioritized in 2011 MTBPS as a key area. The other issue around health is the issue of national health insurance. And the 2011 budget review promised that the financing aspects, long-term financing aspects of national health insurance, there will be a discussion document on it, and the commission is going to comment on those long-term financing aspects. What is pertinent for this MTGPS is the interim financing arrangements for financing the pilot studies, the pilot districts, commencing 2012-13. And the two issues for discussion, they are issues of whether to finance it through the provincial equitable share or through an earmarked conditional grant for the pilots. And as soon as we come to the forthcoming budget, we'll have the actual plans of how the interim financing arrangements are going to be handled. So they are the two issues that we'll be commenting on around conditional grant financing or feeding it through the provincial equitable share. Although tentatively in the document, the commission has already said, since it's a pilot phase, we feel that because from a pilot you want to learn whether a program is scalable or not, it's probably much safer to go through the conditional grant element so that you don't compromise the credibility of the pilots themselves. But we will make more substantive recommendations when we come with our comment on the Division of Revenue Bill in February. Then the other priority is the issue of social security, which is talking about strengthening selected child welfare programs, in particular early childhood development services and home and community-based child care and protection. And we think it's a reasonable shift doing it from using money obtained from the baselines, although we think there needs to be more clarity on exactly what these frontline workers that are being proposed will be doing. Now, coming to the vertical split or the division of revenue, the next slide, Debo. I think what we noticed from that diagram is that a total of 48 billion rands has been added over the MTEF with provinces and municipalities growing, provinces by around 1.4% of, and local government by up to 4%. For provinces, it's essentially to take care of the shortfall in compensation of employees, while for local government is to sustain the provision of free basic services to the poor. I'll ask Teboho to take us through the next set of issues.
Okay, I will cover the proposed adjustments because the request was also to comment on the division of revenue adjustment information on provincial and local government adjustment allocations. Now, in terms of proposed adjustments to the equitable share, what we have found is that 3.2 billion has been added into the fiscus through the equitable share to cover for a shortfall in personal costs. You know, provinces at the beginning of the financial year have been asked to budget for 5.5 in terms of improvements in conditions of service. And the agreement nationally was that public servants have to be compensated by 6.8%, and therefore there is a shortfall of about 1.3%, and this 3.2 billion is the compensation for the difference, that is 1.3%. And this covers both the equitable share and also money that has been sent to provinces to cover for shortfalls in personnel costs in FET colleges. So the distribution of the money to provinces, it will be through the PS, and the same method has been followed to compensate for FET colleges. But broadly, the commission has said that in this tight fiscal framework, we need the government need to be aware of the rising wage bill that is having an impact in terms of budgeting and funding of other government priorities. So we caution against the rising wage bill in as compared to other government priorities as well. And then this slide shows the rolled overs. You must remember that in the 2010-11 financial year, the conditional grants that were stopped in terms of the Division of Revenue Act, and there was a discussion. I remember that the FFC was asked earlier this year to comment on conditional grants that were stopped and not transferred to provinces. So there is an agreement that now the funds will have to be given to those provinces, and this slide shows the different grants and provinces that are going to benefit, and it's about 1.2 billion that has been rolled over. We have raised an issue, really, that if you can see that the most of the grants are infrastructure related, you know, there is difficulty by provinces to spend on infrastructure allocations and the capacity to absorb national funding. So, yes, we agree that the money has been given to them, but whether that the provinces will be able to spend this money come the end of the financial year is another issue. There's been a complaint about the spike, you know, in the fourth quarter in terms of expenditure. And I'd also like to caution the committee to focus on the difference between a transfer and an expenditure, because what happens is that, you know, come the end of maybe the fourth quarter, money is being transferred to suppliers, but it's, you know, so that is indicated as an expenditure, but in real sense that is a transfer, is not an expenditure, and so that, you know, it is reflected as if it's 100% expenditure, but it's something that we, you know, it's a challenge in the system. Well, the amendment bill also shows that there's been some money made for disaster management. We know that we, as a country, we are prone to natural disasters. So there's been 753 million that is being given to provinces to deal with damages to schools, houses, as well as roads. So, yeah. 753 shared across those functional areas. Now, as the commission, we welcome Schedule 9 of the Division of Revenue Bill, which is an act now, which facilitates the faster release of disaster funds. But, you know, moving forward and in the long term, we are saying as the commission that we need to look at other alternative sources. And as the commission, we are currently undertaking a study on the alternative funding disaster, of natural disasters, given, you know, the forecast that, you know, the frequency of those disasters might be high. So we are saying that we need to explore other funding sources and also put an emphasis on risk reduction, that before the occurrence of natural disasters, you know, putting money on maintenance is important as a hedge against natural disasters. So that is what we'd like to see moving forward. Well, the other comment we have is that the issue of performance, especially non-financial data, it's important in the system, because we can see that money is going and funding infrastructure, but in terms of delivery, data is not forthcoming. And we are saying that, you know, there are other issues in the system also. It's not only about money, but the issue of planning and the design of certain conditional grants. We have been coming to the commission around poor expenditure of EPWP incentive grant and its relation to other labor-intensive infrastructure-related grants. You know, so the issue of capacity to spend the grant, but also the design of the grant is another issue that we need to focus on. Then, well, the local government local government grants, the adjustments, we have seen that there are adjustments to the water operating subsidy grant, that is 3.5 million given to Lephala, the municipality. I think this was supposed to have been given to the municipality earlier, but because of system glitches, the money could not be transferred to the municipality. So this is a correction. But also there's 26 million given to Department of Human Settlements for Rural Households Infrastructure Grant. As I mean, it's the rollout of water and sanitation projects. But we are also concerned that in as much as this money has been given to the department, we have noted that there is under expenditure, you know, of this grant in year as well. So there are dangers also that either they might underspend or transfer to suppliers. And also there's money given for regional bulk infrastructure grant. This one, the 790 million grant, which is given to DCOG, is mainly for municipal systems improvement grant that is given to, I think it's Northwest 397 municipality, and is taking into consideration that there was a measure of two municipalities in the local government election, that is Gakusan and Molopo, and I think the committee recommended that those municipalities be given money for systems improvement, and that has been made available. And we have seen that there are savings incurred also in terms of financial management grant, where of overall savings of about 50 million, but 11 million of that is returned to the national fiscals, whilst the 39 million is given for internship, especially technical services, and through the employment of been appropriated through DCOG. And yeah, that's what we found out. And I'll give it over to the chair to conclude.
Slide basically summarizes the issues that we have raised in the submission. I think generally from the Commission's point of view, and I think this is a message that one wants to leave, is that there's quite a lot of activity when it comes to in-year allocations and reallocations, but it's increasing, in fact. One would have expected that in a period like this, where we are going through tight fiscal, we're dealing with tight fiscal frameworks and tight environments, these kinds of readjustments and reallocations and rollovers should not ordinarily be happening. There is a major concern that relates also to specifically to what is happening in local government, where conditional grants are increasingly unspent conditional grants. We have reached a stage where certain municipalities have had to have their equitable share impacted upon because of their failure to utilize conditional grants in the manner in which they were intended. And so these are issues that speak to the long-term credibility of a system. How do we justify a situation where conditional grants are decided upon and then there's a responsibility by the three spheres to ensure that those conditional grants are appropriately spent, and in the end one sphere then basically gets to suffer because there has been a problem. There are certain instances where we need to relook at whether or not we are all at the same level across the three spheres in terms of why we have certain conditional grants and their purpose. Because speaking to municipalities, as a commission which is coming from a public hearing where we invited major stakeholders, including municipalities, there's quite a significant asymmetry of information. Basically in terms of what is happening with respect to some of these things. We can raise the issue of the Sienza Manje, which was raised specifically by two senior officials of in the municipalities that actually for us as a commission we just could not understand why a CFO, for example, of a municipality would actually come up and say they are not aware that Sienza Manje has actually been reformed or reworked or whatever the new incarnation of Sienza Manje project looks like. And so you have a municipal chief financial officer who is not aware that that is actually happening now. Obviously, there is a problem. And in terms of our own intervention, we intervened probably in the wrong way instead of looking at the core of the problem. Some of the problems definitely lie in the design of the grants. Some of them lie in their actual management. And as a commission, we would like to raise this as a specific area that needs to be addressed quite urgently, because it might actually impact on the credibility of the long-term evolution of the intergovernmental transfer system. I think that's the parting point, Chairperson.
Thank you, Mr. Komoreno. Team, honorable members, any questions for clarities? Any comments? Nothing. Okay. There is a hand from Wendy, Treasury. And Mr. Snell, as well as Mr. Sokoni. Thank
you. Just one. Yeah. Come again. Just a few small comments from me from National Treasury side. The first one is just I don't want Northwest 397 municipality to think they're going to get 790 million rand. The conditional grant is half, not even half of that amount. It's actually a third of that amount. So it's 790,000 rand. So that can just be corrected. What is important with regard to that decision, it's specifically linked also to a process that took place when the Division of Revenue Act was, or bill was debated, which then became an act, where the Select Committee on Appropriations recommended that that newly demarcated municipality be allocated money. So the Department of Cooperative Governance secured that money out of their own budget then to allocate to this municipality. So one of the decisions of the appropriation committees have already been implemented. Then with regard to the funding of, or the release of money in terms of the adjustments budget process, the first important point to make is that an adjustment budget is supposed to deal just with unforeseen and unavoidable costs. And so that's why you would see a large focus on things like changes to the salary composition because of wage negotiations, and you'll also see quite a lot of money with regard to disaster money because that is also in-year adjustments. Just with respect to these in-year adjustments for disasters, that is just the first contribution towards the disaster. What happens often afterwards is the longer-term planning related to that can get absorbed into the normal infrastructure grant funding as well. Because how the adjustments budget process works, first the necessary legislation needs to be passed, which takes quite a while. Then after that is then complemented with a government gazette that then needs to be issued. After that has been issued, only then can the funds be released to the provinces and the municipalities concerned. So the earliest that the money can be released to any municipality or province is actually around middle December. And that money then needs to be spent before the end of the national financial year, which is 31 March 2012. So that is often why we've seen disasters. It appears to be quite a small amount, but there is also provision in the 2012 NTF for a number of those conditional grants or disasters to be funded out of conditional grants as well. Then with regard to some of the questions posed and with regard to just two most probably highlights with regard to the 2012 in TFF. And what is very important is that there is a, because we are in a constrained environment on the one hand, and the FFC discussed some of the consequences of that, as well as that there's a renewed focus of government to actually achieve certain specific outcomes. Given that it doesn't necessarily mean that because we're in a constrained environment, it doesn't necessarily mean we can't achieve that. It just needs means that government needs to use its money much smarter. And just to give a few highlights of what has happened in the past, we've had cases, for example, where the KwaZulu-Natal province about 2-3 years ago was in huge financial difficulties. And through prudent and making the right type of decisions and choices, they became more efficient and spent less money and brought their finances under control without having adverse impact on service delivery. And they looked at some of the basics, how can they curtail unnecessary expenditure. And we've had some of the same cases with regard to municipalities, where they've actually done the right thing, where they were in financial difficulties, and just through the necessary prudency measures, i.e. stopping wasting of money on the wrong things, they've actually turned their municipality around as well. So that is also an issue that the committee should really focus on, is getting that, not just focusing on what money is allocated, but also focusing on how it is spent. For example, the SALGO presentation made quite a lot of proposals that infrastructure grant conditional money should be increased. But what we should first focus on is actually getting the existing money that's in the system spent. So that we can actually avoid the situation that money gets returned to the fiscus because municipalities are not spending it appropriately, and the FFC has made some very valid points. Let's look at some of the conditional grants. Let's see if they're optimally structured. Let's work with the national departments concerned to reform the grant system, the existing systems, to work better so that we can get better expenditure, because both with regard to provinces and municipalities, the sad news is the following. Their spending on conditional grants are not improving. It's most probably declining. So that is where we need to actually invest our energies into, which is very important. Thanks for listening. Thanks.
Thank you, ma'am. Mr. Snell?
Thanks, Chair. Chair, I'm going to ask the Commission if they believe that we can integrate budgets and outcomes to achieve the national developmental agenda across all spheres of government in an integrated and coordinated manner within the context of the independence of the various spheres of government and the legislative framework that was enacted prior to us pursuing a developmental agenda. And if they believe that can't be done, what do they think should be done? Thank you.
Mr. Sokwane and Mr. Sindler.
Thank you. Chair, I don't know if I missed my question regarding the payment of the gratuities to the councillors. And then, secondly, Chair, Honourable De Beers, also from the Northern Cape, and he understands the dilemma that we sit there with the floods and so on. So firstly, I think it's important that one welcomes this input regarding maybe an alternate approach. But reality is that if you look at the amounts that have been appropriated, it's a drop in the ocean. I know that there's other packages at the IDC and so on and so forth. But with due respect, this bit of money, I don't think it would take, would address 10% of the damage to infrastructure, for instance, in the Upington area. The only way that you can manage the floods in that area is if you manage the infrastructure. Now, the infrastructure has been destroyed. So I was grateful, but I don't honestly think it's going to address the challenge.
Can you repeat your question on that councillor's gratuity amount so that it can be properly attended to?
Yes. Chair, the Seriti Commission, which deals with the remuneration of public office bearers, recommended that councillors that weren't elected during the May elections get the 3 months gratuity. Now, it's been appropriated now in this recent in the recent budget. Now, the challenge is, and that's where I get calls from ex-councillors asking me what's happening, because they go to the municipalities, they ask, when will they get this money, this 3 months refund? And I just thought that maybe the officials of Treasury or even SALGA would respond to that.
Yeah, SALGA has indicated that they will respond in writing, but if National Treasury can respond, they can. Mr. Ramasakane?
Well, thanks, Chair. I wonder if the Treasury, I thought they would comment on the slide number 13, I think, that from the presentation. That is the OSDs. I think there is a concern that continuously comes to the fore. And I think that all of us has been raising this issue, that issue seems to be a moving target. It's ever unending. It continues. What a comment from Treasury with respect to that. On that same slide, there is, and I think Treasury has found that's probably outcome issues. I know the words are used interchangeably, do they mean the same thing? The more we use them, it becomes the words that we quite not sure what we mean by them. Now I wonder your comment. I thought the most important part of that sentence, the whole thing about adjustment of EFT wage, that should be linked to the output. Now I see this addition and the outcome from these colleges. Now I just then it's you strengthening it and watering it down at the same time. Now that's, I just wanted to just get some clarity from yourself. I thought that let me leave it there.
Marlo.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me just respond to Honorable Snell's very difficult question. The Constitution assigns specific functions to specific spheres of government. It also assigns, on the other side, revenue sources, part of which entails the equitable share, which becomes an entitlement to each sphere of government, to the three spheres of government. So you can count it as an own revenue source that basically belongs to that sphere. Now, Section 2142 then speaks to the criteria that must be used to share that revenue and how the revenue will then be utilized. So it does not specify that this amount of revenue will be in the form of conditional grants, this amount of revenue will be in the form of non-conditional grants, or this amount of revenue will be in the form of the equitable share. The Financial and Fiscal Commission, on the basis of the dispensation at that particular point, and I think for those of you who still remember, the Financial and Fiscal Commission, when it first made its set of recommendations, the method that was being applied was a method where there were function committees that were basically allocating resources to the different sectors. The Commission then decided that that kind of an approach was not the most transparent, and therefore we needed a formula that would basically allocate resources. And that is the evolution of the current transfer system. So there is a formula that allocates the equitable share, and then there are conditional grants that come into the picture that are for specific programs or recognize certain fiscal dynamics within across the provinces, such as your health conditional grants, like your national tertiary services grants, your health professions training and development. So all of those had a context at that particular point in time. Government had a particular way of achieving its objectives. And the Commission's work basically starts from what the government's objectives are in terms of the policy, what is the constitutional imperatives relating to the intergovernmental system, and then recommendations are made. In 2007, there was an issue that was raised with the Commission and also with the then Minister of Finance through the Budget Council, by the then Minister of Education, Honorable Naledi Pandor. She raised an issue of the constraints that the funding of concurrent functions is actually faced with. And at that particular point in time, a lot of things were happening. So that was in 2007. 2008, there were changes that happened that resulted in government adopting a different type of approach to service delivery, which basically becomes now your outcomes-based approach. And so you've got this number of outcomes that have been predetermined, and various departments are clustering around those outcomes because of the interlocks that they have. Now, the current revenue sharing mechanism is in such a way that we divide revenue outside of looking at what these issues are. Now, you can look at them from a vertical division process, but once the money gets to where it's supposed to go, whether it's a province or a municipality, if you're talking about the equitable share, it becomes very important for provinces, Honorable Snell, because about 95-96% of provincial revenue is in the form of the equitable share, where they have maximum discretion in terms of budget preparation. So we can have these things and say we will for education, we have this kind of money that we require, so we decide up there. We go to the Division of Revenue process. It must still be budgeted for in a province by its own province, its own executive, and so on and so forth. So those decisions might not necessarily tally with what the vertical division was informed by. And these are the national priorities and the imperatives on those outcomes. So at a provincial level, it might not necessarily tally because in one province, certain issues might be different from the other province and the pressing needs might be different. And so when a province makes its own budget, it exercises executive authority and similarly in a municipality. But with municipalities, because we must be concerned with the money that we're sharing, taxpayers in a municipality must hold the municipality accountable for decisions that it takes with their taxes. But at the level at which the commission operates, it's the revenue sharing mechanism that we are more concerned about at this particular point in time. Now, at local government level, you've got conditional grants. They constitute far much more than the equitable share in terms of the share, whereas it's the opposite with provinces. So the decisions that are taken by a province on concurrent functions are very important at a national level. Now, in the absence of norms and standards, you cannot ensure that the money that you've allocated for education will actually be spent for education when it gets to a provincial level. It's really the decisions of a province. But if you have norms and standards, it might actually be a better issue. Now, from the Commission's point of view, the current way in which the equitable share is distributed or is allocated is no longer consistent. And I must tell you that it's no longer consistent with the delivery model that government actually uses. So there is a need for a more thorough review of the transfer sharing system with respect to the provincial equitable share. At the moment, it cannot actually tally with the, and so we still have the issues around the concurrent functions. We've been depending or relying on what you call cooperative governance, that's chapter 3. So let me say, it's possible, but the current system constrains it. There are constraints to that. The other issue that was asked is with respect to the funding allocated for disaster. I'm not sure whether that question, whether it's sufficient, because the point is you spend and then you get paid afterwards. So what she has basically said is that this is not what they've allocated now is just for this financial year, but going forward there's obviously there will be something else that one would expect to be there. So this one is to carry somebody for unforeseen and unavoidable. And I want to come back to that, but unforeseen and unavoidable, we need maybe a clearer definition of what actually qualifies, because what makes it vague is that it's a subjective term, so it makes it very vague. On the issue of the OSD, I suppose Wendy would respond to that, but from the Commission's perspective, I think this committee is aware what the Commission's position is, and the recommendation was already put. The output versus outcome question, I don't think this is the first time that I have to respond to you on this particular one. I think the issue is for anything that you produce, if you want to look at it that way, for anything that you produce, there has to be an end. What is the end result that you want? So if you take kids through school, you can take them through school and you produce 35 of them, they have passed. But what is it that they can do? Are they literate? Are they numerate? Are they... So those are the differences, that a school system must produce literate and numerate, not just graduates. Literate and numerate graduates are two different things. I think that's the point. Can I stop here, Chair?
Thank you, Ms. Fanu.
Thank you very much. With regard to the first question, just to support what Mr. Kumalo had to say about the disasters, and unfortunately, we cannot talk about the 2012 budget at this stage, but what I can do is just quote a section out of the MTBBS, which actually gives an indication of what we're going to work towards in the 2012 budget. If you can look on page 44, it says here under the provincial conditional grants, and the last sentence under that, it says further resources are made available over the MTF to fund repairs to roads, buildings and other infrastructure damaged by the floods in January and February 2011. We will, when we present the 2012 budget in on 22 February 2012, we will provide that further details. Given, and the reason why the amount is this amount is because it's when the money can be released, which is only in December at the soonest. And I'll explain the reason a bit behind that as well. And the same answer will apply with regard to the other question about the once-off gratuity. We first need to conclude the process related to the Division of Revenue Amendment process as well as the appropriation amendment process. When it relates to something that's a provincial allocation or municipal allocation, which is the disasters for provinces fall under that calculation, the committees must first approve and adopt the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill, then the President needs to sign it, and after that a gazette must be issued in terms of a government notice that then releases the amounts. So the soonest that money can be released is because of that process. It is then middle of December at the soonest. With regard to the question on with regard to the once of gratuity, that is not a provincial or a municipal allocation. That allocation was just shown in our process under the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill because it relates to a or benefit to the municipalities. But that money will be placed on the Department of Cooperative Governance vote, and it will be formally dealt with through the appropriation amendment bill process. And when approved, the same will apply. It will then be allocated then to the Department of Cooperative Governance, but only after that process has been concluded. So the soonest the money can be released, again, is middle December. But what will happen in the interim is that National Treasury will be working also with the Department of Cooperative Governance to get the details sorted out in that respect. But the Department of Cooperative Governance will be leading that process, and the money will be on their budget. But they've also been in consultation in that on that regard with SALGO as well, so that the details in that regard will then be worked out as well. Then with regard to the other issue mentioned, yes, and it will be quickly, and it's got to do with the OSD and whether it's underfunded or not. Again, the question is not whether necessarily whether they're underfunded. Substantial resources have been made available for OSD to provinces, and the majority of OSDs have been finalised now. But there needs to be a difference between over expenditure, what appears to be apparent over expenditure, and the actual provision. For example, we need to also take into account that provinces, a lot of those things they did not correctly implement. And for example, you would get cases where a number of provinces, it's what we refer to as access teachers or park teachers, where teachers are more than what are allocated to a specific school, but they've got, in certain provinces, they've got an overemployment of about 1,000 teachers, which is over and above to what the norms and standards are saying. And then that is shown as over expenditure. It's not necessarily over expenditure. It's the province not managing their budgets appropriately for personnel. And that is a key issue that needs to be looked at. And National Treasury has started the process also with the Department of Public Service and Administration to actually see how what can we can actually do differently to get personnel budgets under control. Because it's often a case that these access teachers, which is not benefiting the system. Again, the same applies in health. There's bad management of personnel. You get a lot of cases where people are employed over and above what's required or stated in the establishment. I mean, that is just bad management. You cannot argue that that is the fiscus is underfunding them. So there's quite a lot of fat that is currently in the system, and it's more prevalent in specific provinces. It's not the case in all provinces. And what is needed is better and more prudent personnel management. And like I said, National Treasury is working with the provincial treasuries. We're also working with the National Department of Public Service and Administration to get some of these glitches sorted out. And hopefully we'll sort out these type of challenges going forward. Thanks.
Thank you, Mrs. Fano. I think the issue of OSDs, like we have said also, that in other areas it's been finalized, in others. Perhaps if we could engage further on that and get some more details when we meet again sometimes next week, so that we are able to make informed decisions insofar as that is concerned. Honourable members, I think we have come to an end of this session. This was the only presentations for today, and as you know, we had planned presentation for today and Friday, but there's nothing for Friday in terms of submissions. So this is the only, this was the last submission on this, the Division of Revenue as well as the MTPPS. And let me thank SALGAD, Treasury, as well as the FFC for coming through. And I'm going to request honourable members that the members of the Standing Committee, whilst I suspend the proceedings, you are going to be proceeding for the next 5 minutes just to adopt your report. Thank you very much, honourable members.
Thank you very much. I'm not sure if we need 5 minutes, but that's
want to have that opportunity. We adopt it later. Honorable Swart? Honorable Ramatlagan?
Chair, I received the report this morning, and when people were talking too much, I read the report, so I'm quite happy that the details in that report is absolutely spot on, and I see that we recommend that this committee recommends that we be adopted by Parliament, and I'm quite happy with that. The DA is happy with that. So as far as I'm concerned, I would like to propose that we adopt the report as it stands.
Do you propose an adoption? Honourable Matlakane, we want to second that.
Well, yes, I have no problem in adopting the report. It's a straightforward report. There's nothing that changes on the report. So I agree with the Honourable here that we must adopt it now and get done with it.
Members, just on for record, I do want to say that we do form the quorum. Honourable Snell is with us, just gone out. Honourable Dr. Rabi was here, so we form the quorum. So the report has been duly, what you call, adopted. And the chairpersons can come in.
I just want to say that Honorable Rabi Chair has read the report and he indicated to me that he's happy with it.
All you guys have your own problems.